Thanks for listening to this podcast of Faith Radio Mornings from Faith Radio. Tuesday morning, the 26th of June. The sun is rising. It is behind some clouds here in the Minneapolis-St. Paul area, but we know it's there. And what we know for sure is that tomb is empty again this morning. Good news indeed for those of us who are followers of Jesus. When life feels hopeless, when it feels like we can't find our way, we can always point to the good news of the gospel that he is risen. He's risen indeed. You are listening to Faith Radio Mornings. I'm your host, Dr. Peter Kapsner, and joined in studio, as always, by Logan Rausch, running the sound and the board, and show producer Paul Perreault in the newsroom. Grateful to him and to Rachel Sutton, who do a great job booking these guests that help us walk through so many of the headlines of the day, as well as just different topics that are always top of the mind. And Logan, you know, I was looking again at the headlines this morning, and as much grief as I give you, kind of show in and show out, and you back to me, and that's helpful because teasing is one of my love languages. I know it's not one of the five, but it should be. They need to write a new book that has like teasing and chocolate and golf as love languages and stuff. But I'm just curious, as we go through these different headlines, what does the world look like through your eyes as a 22-year-old? As you're kind of entering into the world, how are you processing all of this from that kind of age at 22?
Well, it's definitely still a formative time. I mean, I'm young. I haven't been through the experiences, especially when we talk about things that are so political. A lot of people have this reference to, well, during the last presidential era, during the last presidential era, I couldn't vote, so I didn't pay attention.
Good point.
So this is still a very formative time where I'm really feeling out what's coming in and how I feel about it. So I'm still working on all of it, but definitely, especially the one thing that's on the mind of most every American is the border issue. And right where I'm at and where a lot of people are is young people are very passionate about the emotional caring for people and the action of helping people. I mean, missions work and all of that is so important. And so there's this desire to really, you know, be as helpful and as welcome as we can, but to temper that with, okay, what does it mean for our country and how cautious do we need to be? That's something that I can't answer yet and is something that if you have kids who are teenagers or this age, is something that is important to walk through with them and take in the information lightly and casually and try to understand it rather than just react to it.
That's a great point. And do you find that it's helpful to talk to people, the next generation, at times in terms of just sorting through some of these headlines? You try to just sort of figure things out at your own. Where do you land on this piece of it?
No. Anyone older than 25 is old and irrelevant.
So, I am out. You do. You actually just ignore me all morning in the studio, and then the lights kick on, and you'll talk to me for a little bit, which I appreciate, Logan. I feel relevant when we have our conversations.
No, most definitely. I mean, there is so much wisdom in, you know, people say that young people don't want to listen to the older generation anymore, but it's not true. I really do care so much about what, you know, my parents, my grandparents, my neighbors, my pastors have to say and be able to speak into my life. And so I do want to hear those opinions and I do want to hear those insights, but there's a caution that comes with that. People don't want to be, young people especially, don't want to feel like they're being spoken to or spoken at. They want information, but they don't want to be told how they should feel. And so if you've ever had a conversation with your teens or someone that's your youth group, be very careful. They may not be receiving your message, not because they don't like your message, but because of how you're giving it to them.
That makes perfect sense. Well, I love our conversations in the morning. I love going through so much of what's top of the mind news. And again, the great guests and sorting this out together. And again, we do have good guests this morning. We'll take a short break. And Tommy Binion of the Heritage Foundation, who located out of Washington, D.C., will just walk through headline after headline and get some insight as to what's happening in the world. Again, good morning, everybody. It's Faith Radio Mornings. I'm Dr. Peter Kapsner. We'll take a short break and be right back. It is 10 minutes past the hour, and you're listening to Faith Radio Mornings. I'm Dr. Peter Kapsner, and we are joined, as we often are at this time in the week, by Tommy Binion of the Heritage Foundation in Washington, D.C. And Tommy joins us to sort of sort through again the ongoing headlines of the day. Good morning, Tommy.
Good morning. How's it going this morning?
Well, it's great here in Minneapolis. It's a little rainy. It's it's a little dark and stuff. How is it in Washington, D.C.?
So far, so good. I think we're going to have one of those partly cloudy June days.
Love it. Say, we've got a lot of headlines, of course, at the border. We've got gerrymandering you can talk us through. We have the comments of Maxine Waters yesterday. But the headline that really grabbed my attention, I would love your comments on to help me sort through this, is that it says in San Francisco that the first ever fully robotically made hamburger restaurant is set to open. And the robots will actually slice and toast buns, grind and sear the meat, and assemble the burger to order in 5 minutes. They'll be organic, locally sourced, and they'll cost just $6. And Tommy, are you going to a robot-oriented restaurant like this?
Absolutely, especially for a $6 organic fresh hamburger.
That was my thought.
Why not?
Yeah, if my dog made that hamburger for $6, I might go to that.
That's a great price, especially in the heart of San Francisco. Hamburgers there cost like $25.
Yeah, I agree. $6 is normally the cover charge just to even start thinking about the organic burger. So let's go to some of the headlines, Tom. You're so helpful with this each week. And, you know, don't want to spend a ton of time on the border, but we do need to mention it again. And of course, some of what came out yesterday was that the president suggested that we should not even have due process, maybe, or we shouldn't be hiring the judges down at the border to sort out people coming across. They should just be turned away and said, why don't you enter the border legally? And then at that point, we can deal with the situation. But it sort of empowers people to keep coming across illegally if they have the opportunity for due process in that circumstance. What are your thoughts on that? Walk us through that piece of it.
Yeah, well, you know, what the president said made sense to me. The group of people that we're having trouble with is the group of people that is caught coming across the border. They're not at a port of entry. They're not at a U.S. consulate in Mexico. They're caught coming across the border. And once they're caught, then they claim asylum. So we have to prosecute them for the crime of coming across the border. That's part of President Trump's zero tolerance policy, which is the only way you're ever going to have a secure border. And then we have to adjudicate their asylum claim. It sounds to me that what President Trump is suggesting is we turn people away and tell them, look, go to a port of entry and claim asylum, or go to a U.S. consulate in Mexico and claim asylum. That's where you are supposed to claim asylum. In my view, that's how it absolutely should work. The media, though, they're calling this a deportation. We're catching somebody sneaking across the border and refusing them entry is now being classified as a deportation. I think the reaction now that this separation of family story has gone this far and this long, and of course it's heartbreaking, but now that we're in this space, I think the media's reaction to everything President Trump does on the border is going to be hyperbolic. I think it's going to be Looney Tunes. No matter what he does, the media is going to react this way.
And I want to get into it just a minute. There was some claims that came out in some of the popular headlines like USA Today that we're entering into an era as a country of maybe a soft civil war, and because there's just such this polarization on both sides. So we'll get into that in just a minute. But going back to this border issue for another question is, would it be possible, knowing that some of these families, and many of them, frankly, are pretty destitute and fleeing countries that are drug-ridden and violent and very difficult, could we set up a situation in which if they arrive at the border illegally, that there could be a transportation system for them to take them to the ports of entry that are legal, just to acknowledge that, hey, you're here, we're going to help you get through the border illegally, as opposed to just turning them back and say, deal with it yourself?
That's an idea, and it's certainly one that comes from the right place, having sympathy from these people that are having a tough go. I think what you want to avoid for sure is incentivizing people showing up on the border. Part of the problem here is that our policy, which is one that's built out of generosity and soft hearts, is one that incentivizes people to come to the border. The first thing they do is they try to cross the border, and if they can get across without being caught, that's great. And if they get caught, then they know, well, the thing to do is to claim asylum. Whether they think they have a credible fear of returning to their home country or not, they're going to claim asylum because they think that's the ticket to get to stay. And I think some of them have completely legitimate, credible fears and to claim asylum, and some of them don't. So what you want to be careful of in setting up any new policy, like you're suggesting, where we're transferring people across the border to ports of entry and things, is incentivizing it. Because the more we incentivize people showing up on the border, the harder it's going to be to secure the border. And I'm not suggesting tough love necessarily for those that have showed up on the border, but there has got to be some way to send a message to somebody in another country thinking about trying to immigrate here illegally that it's not going to end well for them. Otherwise, we're just going to get more and more and more of it.
Is there a reason, Tommy, why people don't go to the legal ports of entry in these situations and walk through that? Or is it just they get to the border however they can? What would be the reason why somebody would go to a place where it's illegal to enter?
Well, I think you can't generalize here, because all of the stories of the families and the individuals that wind up on the border, all of them are unique. All of them are different. Some of them, they're just confused. You know, they're just coming. They're just confused. Many of them, on the other hand, they will pay a smuggler. They will pay what's known as a coyote. It's $2,000 or $3,000. They will pay somebody, and they will be coached on how to do this. And the first step of the coaching is just try going across the border. And if you get across and you don't get caught, you're in. And then the smugglers say, if you do get caught, what you need to do is use this wording and claim asylum, and you will be treated in this way based on the U.S. legal system. So a lot of the problem down there is coaching of the immigrants to game the system, as it were. And so I think that's why it happens, is because the step one of this process is let's give it a go. Let's see if we can cross the border illegally, and many of them make it across. The ones that we're having trouble with, other than the ones that make it across and are now living in this country illegally, are the ones that we catch, and then they're coached to game our legal system.
Speaking with Tommy Binion of the Heritage Foundation, just talking through again some of the top-of-the-mind news items. It's 17 minutes past the hour. We'll take a short break, Tommy, and when we come back, want to get into how difficult it is to even create policy these days, given how polarized everything is. Short break. It's Faith Radio Mornings. We'll be right back. It is 20 minutes past the hour on Faith Radio Mornings. I'm your host, Dr. Peter Kapsner, in studio with Logan Rausch, and joined on the line by Tommy Binion of the Heritage Foundation out of Washington, D.C. And Tommy, before the break, obviously, we were talking a bit about the difficulty of creating policy that makes sense, that's compassionate, that is truthful, that is all of the above. And it seems like it's increasingly difficult these days to even have the conversation when people like Maxine Waters come out yesterday, and in response to the harassing that's been going on to Trump cabinet members that really came to a head this weekend with Sarah Huckabee Sanders in the Red Hen restaurant. And Maxine Waters came out and said, you know, we really need to harass the cabinet members of the president wherever they are, wherever we see them. The people are going to turn on them. They're going to protest for some of her quotes as well. And she said, if you see anybody from the cabinet in a restaurant, in a department store, a gasoline station, create a crowd and push back on them. This doesn't seem terribly helpful for the process moving forward.
No, it's certainly not helpful. I hope that Congresswoman Waters realizes that what she said was really dangerous and damaging. I saw that Whip Scalise, who was a victim of a politically motivated shooting last summer, came out and made a statement about this, and I liked what his spokesman had to say about it. We shouldn't be politicizing the private lives of our politicians. We shouldn't be subjecting them to sort of mob rule, which I think is a way of describing what Maxine Waters is suggesting here. We have civil dialogue and civil discourse and debate and deliberation in this country. We don't have harassment and mobs and public shaming and things like that. I think that what happened to Sarah Huckabee Sanders is a real shame. I like what Senator Marco Rubio had to say about this. He said, look, when this happens, you're only making it more likely that President Trump gets reelected. The heart of American people is not with these actions. They don't like to see that. This will create sympathy in them for President Trump, and it will make them see the left as hardened and callous, and you know, sort of like they're looking down on the rest of us, which is how they feel already. We feel that the liberals are looking down on us, like we're not able to manage our own lives, and this type of incident only makes that worse. So I think I think that if the left keeps going with this, eventually it will backfire.
I think you're totally right, Tommy. I mean, when I look at this upcoming election, and it's definitely a changing of minds and a changing of hearts or whatever have you, but I do. I look at the left side calling Trump a bully and calling everyone a bully, and now we're advocating for this idea to bully people in their private lives. That doesn't make me feel good at all. I mean, that's hypocrisy to a level that I can't even imagine.
No, and it becomes impossible to move forward at that point. Once there's a hard divide like that, and there's us and there's them, and when we see them in public, we're going to attack them, there's no open hearts and open ears and open minds and room for compromise. There is a zero-sum game. Either we win or they win. That's where the real damage is. Yeah, I think there is a danger that some of these protests or some of these pushing back on them that Maxine Waters called it become violent. We've seen that over the last year or so, but I think the real danger is that the divide amongst Americans, which is ideological and political, becomes hardened, and there's no way to bridge it. There's no way to forge a compromise, and we're not listening to each other anymore. We're just screaming at each other. That's not the society that I want to live in. That's not the society that I think that America promises. And we've got to be really, really vigilant when that becomes threatened.
I was reading an article yesterday, Tommy, about the idea that marriages often are on the brink of failure when disagreements turn into contempt for one another. And it sure seems like we've crossed a divide a bit where we can't have these mutual conversations. There's legitimately contempt. There's hatred for one another. Is there any way coming back from the brink of that? Is there even just historically have parties that have disagreed so profoundly? Can they come back and come together again? What does that usually take?
Well, I think the sad truth is it usually takes a tragedy. We had a great bipartisan display of patriotism for years after the September 11th attacks that we experienced. And I think that the sad truth is those are the types of events that bring us together as Americans, where it sort of takes somebody grabbing us by the lapels and shaking us and pointing out that we agree on more than we disagree. But it, you know, I think what could, hopefully we never experience another tragedy like that again. I think another thing that will bring us together is leadership, bipartisan leadership. We've got to have leadership from the Republicans and leadership from the Democrats. They've got to forge a compromise and then sell it to us together. Right now, the problem that we're experiencing is that it's a zero-sum game. If President Trump has a victory, that's a defeat for the Democrats. And if the Democrats have a victory, that's a defeat for President Trump. Well, in those scenarios, as Americans, we're either winning or we're losing. And I wish that our politicians would fight for wins and losses for us, not wins and losses for our political parties. As long as they're playing the zero-sum game, I think we're losing. And so I think that in the past, a tragedy has brought us back together. But I think political leadership and bipartisan leadership could do the trick this time.
It's Tommy Binion of the Heritage Foundation. Tommy, we just have about 30 seconds left. What are you looking for in some of the primaries that are coming up here today?
Well, so Mitt Romney is going to, I think, win the Utah primary. That's extraordinarily interesting.
It is.
I think not a lot of Americans have sort of realized that he's in this race, that he's coming to the Senate. But I think that because he will have won an election here tonight, the focus will be on him. He's got extremely high name ID, and so his presence back on the American political scene could shake things up. I think that might be the most interesting storyline of tonight.
Tommy, great to have you on as always. Thanks for joining us and enjoy your afternoon and the rest of the morning in Washington.
You bet. Thanks a lot. Have a great show.
It is 27 minutes past the hour. We'll take a break for Lighten Up and the news. And when we come back in the second half of the hour, we'll be speaking about gender dysphoria and the importance of maintaining gender distinctions with Mona Charon, an author whose book is coming out today. So stay with us. Logan, love the conversation with Tommy, and even it's sobering to think about how often that countries and kingdoms in this world are unfortunately they're renewed through difficult events or even through war. So often it's different than the one kingdom of Jesus that in which we walk that was birthed through self-sacrifice and love and not war.
We can only have hope and prayer that we can come back to a unification of that level. I mean, we were talking off the air. The closest this country's ever been united was like right after Pearl Harbor and for the longest time. And we can only hope that we can have some sort of movement like Jesus brought of peace and love rather than a horrible tragedy that just really turns our anger somewhere else.
Well, we can certainly model it in our churches and our families, you know, coming back together that way. Let's take a short break for news, and then we'll come back for the second half of the hour with Mona Charon. Of Lisa Bevere. We have a short clip from her, speaker and author. She is talking about what it means to have fierce faith and how it changes our prayer life.
Fierce faith is when you actually aren't just like, oh, I hope it's going to happen. It's actually when you start to pray in ways that actually scare you. They're such big prayers. They're attached to the Word of God. Like, you can't even frame the kind of prayers that you would want to pray with your own natural environment, what your family's done, what you've known. So you open up the Word of God and you begin to pray His kind of prayers, and something inside of you is fierce and ferocious and tenacious, and you're willing to not only pray that, you're willing to stand and fight for that. And that's the kind of fierce faith that we need.
That is Lisa Bevere. If you want to catch that entire segment, you can head to myfaithradio.com. You can search for Fierce Faith and listen to everything that she has there. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, you'll want to stay with us. I had an opportunity to tape an interview yesterday with author Mona Charon, who is coming out with a book today called Sex Matters. And she does, a great job carving out a middle way of the importance of gender distinction and feminism and all of these topics that are so confusing so often for us. So stay with us. We'll be right back.
There is a truth that goes beyond us. It predates us, and it will outlive us. It's called biblical truth. This is Jim Garlow. What's your source of wisdom? Ultimately, my opinion matters little. And sorry to say, same for yours. But there's a truth that does matter. It's called biblical truth. Some will say, well, according to whose interpretation? The answer, according to collective minds of authentic followers of God for the last 2,000 years. Others will argue, well, it's his interpretation against yours, right? No, the Bible was written quite plainly. Tearing up a baby in the womb is anti-biblical. Redefining marriage is anti-biblical. Depriving people of expressing true creativity through excessive governmental control denies the integrity of the human spirit, made in his image. It's anti-biblical. This Bible can spare us a lot of pain, personally and nationally, if we'll read it and follow it. There's more at jimgarlow.com.
Good morning. You are listening to Faith Radio Mornings. I'm your host, Dr. Peter Kapsner, and delighted to be joined at this time by author Mona Charon, who has written a book, Sex Matters, How Modern Feminism Lost Touch with Science, Love, and Common Sense. Just with all the headlines around hashtag Me Too and the ongoing tension and conversations between men and women in our culture, so timely to have you on this morning, Mona. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So in your book, you use this word feminism, which can be a loaded term. And I know I've always understood feminism to mean supporting equal rights and opportunities for women. And by that definition, I think many of us, myself included, would consider ourselves feminist. But how does that fit in with your definition of feminism?
So I would agree. I too would fall into that category if that were the definition. Unfortunately, the feminist movement, as we've come to understand it over the last 40 to 50 years has been a movement that has been about denying that there are any differences between the sexes, that has made free abortion or unlimited abortion a tenet of its worldview, that embraced the sexual revolution, and that felt the family was a trap for women. So for all of those reasons, and because so many feminists fall into the category of believing those things, I hesitate to adopt the label. And, you know, a lot of American women also reject the label feminist for these same reasons. They find them extreme.
And it sounds like in just doing some of the research of feminism that, again, we sort of associate this movement with civil rights in the 1950s and the 1960s, but it has its roots far longer than that, even hundreds of years. Can you talk about some of the early roots of feminism and how it's different than the civil rights version of the 50s and 60s?
Right. In the early 19th century and even into the 18th century, you had writers who were exploring the ideas of female equality, an idea that was radical at the time, since most people believed that women were by nature inferior to men. But you had writers like Mary Wollstonecraft and John Stuart Mill argue that, no, the women were not inferior. They were just different. And that women deserve to be educated. They deserve to have full civil and political rights. And that is a very old tradition. The suffragists in the early part of the 20th century argued, of course, for women to be enfranchised. All of those things are uncontroversial. Unfortunately, what came along in the 70s had a very different intellectual pedigree. The 70s were the birth of the gender feminists, of the radical feminists, who were part of the New Left and embraced the kind of radical agenda of Marxism, of Freudianism. They were ready to upend traditional structures. They embraced the sexual revolution, thinking that sexual liberation was part of women's liberation. And I argue in Sex Matters that we could have embraced all the equality in the workplace and full civil and political rights without going to the extreme of A, denying that men and women are different, and B, smashing the family, which feminists often call the patriarchy.
We're talking with Mona Charon in the book Sex Matters, How Modern Feminism Lost Touch with Science, Love, and Common Sense. And Mona, there's so many directions we can go in this conversation. I don't even hardly know which string to pull, but I love just that subtitle about common sense. And you make some suggestions in the book that there really is significant scientific research on the differences between men and women, which is different than today's sort of cultural sound bites that's trying to collapse these differences. And you notice some obvious things that really are scientifically based that are different between men and women.
Yes. I mean, look, no one would deny or could possibly deny that culture has an influence on behavior. Of course it does. That's why people who live in Tibet behave differently from people who live in Miami. Of course, culture matters. But when you see certain traits that show up in the first days of infancy, for example, female babies are more attentive and pay attention longer to the sound of a human in distress than male babies. And male babies are drawn more to flashing lights and things that move. These things show up so early that they can't possibly have been socially imposed. Similarly, when you see traits that are universal and that are found in every culture and every time and place, for example, when people are looking for possible mates, men tend to prefer physical attractiveness and youth, and women tend to prefer resources. And this is universal. So we all notice it. We've all seen it. And yet to say that it is something that might be innate is considered controversial. So I try to say in the book, look, these are the data. This is what we've seen over the course of all of human history. It's very unlikely that that is socially constructed.
And is it important to hold on to some measure of distinctive and difference between the genders? What would be the importance of that in your mind?
So first of all, it's important to understand ourselves so that we don't get into situations where because we have unrealistic expectations of the other sex, we think there's something wrong with our boyfriend, our husband, our son, our daughter, etc. There are certain kinds of traits. So, for example, and this usually, when I mention this, makes men laugh, especially married men. There is a limit to how much men are going to be willing to listen to a woman describe in very minute detail a social interaction. He's going to listen for a while, and he's going to be attentive. But after a while, he's going to say, you should do X, Y, or Z, and that's the end of it. It doesn't mean that he's an insensitive lout or that he doesn't love you. It's just that when you want to have those long, in-depth conversations about feelings and about analyzing, you know, personal behavior down to the smallest detail, call your sister, call your girlfriends. That's what they're for. Don't think there's something wrong with your husband or your boyfriend.
Go ahead.
No, that's, go ahead.
It just sounds like this could alleviate some of the tensions we end up in these conversations, just understanding some of these basic differences and navigating them well. I love the phrase insensitive lout. Maybe it's not all about that.
Right, exactly. And there are many other reasons to be at peace with our natures. Look, we devote a huge amount of attention and effort, speaking of things being socially constructed, our society devotes a huge amount of effort to trying to make the sexes androgynous. And people, and not just our society, Western Europe too, and we have to ask whether that's really the best use of our social capital. Do we want to work really hard to convince women that they should go back to work as soon as they've given birth? Rather than in being realistic about the fact that most women want to spend time with their babies. On the other hand, do we want to push back against the male tendency to be to sexually misbehave and attempt to put the moves on as many women as possible? Mm-hmm. I mean, those things are both natural. One of them, I think, deserves to be encouraged, that is, women's desire to care for children, which is a wonderful thing. The other one deserves to be discouraged, men's sort of randiness when it comes to sex. So I think we have to be a little more careful about what we choose to suppress and what we choose to encourage.
It's Mona Charon with the book Sex Matters. We'll take a short break, and let's keep getting into this, Mona. It's great stuff, and we'll talk more about the differences and the importance of them between men and women. Stay with us. It's Faith Radio Mornings. I'm Dr. Peter Kapsner. Good morning, it's Faith Radio Mornings, and I'm Dr. Peter Kapsner, and just thrilled to be joined at this time by Mona Charon, the author of the book Sex Matters, and we're talking about differences between men and women. We're untying some of these terms that get chucked around in our society around feminism and how they get defined. And Mona, before the break, we are talking a bit about the differences between men and women. And one of the things you mentioned that you think should be encouraged is that women tend to want to care for children. Talk about the importance of valuing that as opposed to that being a lesser than vocation in our culture.
Right. So many women feel that in some sense, because of the influence of feminism and because of what they've been taught in school, that it's somehow letting down the side if they decide to say they have a college degree and they decide they're going to cut back after they have children, which many, many women do. In fact, a majority of mothers do. We shouldn't regard that as any sort of a loss for anyone. It is a good thing to have children cared for by their parents. By the way, I'm fine with fathers taking time off too. Mm-hmm. There are some families that reverse it, and that's fine, as long as the child gets what he or she needs. But this notion that the caring side of femininity is something that's been imposed on us by our culture and is not innate, I dispute strenuously. I felt it as a mother, even with my first son who was adopted. I felt this tremendous need to be there. And my husband was also very attached to our children, but he felt it in a little bit of a different way. His feelings, and, you know, this may be partially socially constructed and partially natural, but his feeling was, I have a deep responsibility to take care of my family, whether it means working harder or just being there and you know, spelling my wife when she's tired and, you know, taking turns at night with feedings and whatever it is. But, you know, I could not have happily just dropped the baby with a sitter and gone, or a daycare and gone back to work. I just was not comfortable with that. And a lot of women feel that way, and that should be honored. The data on daycare are not very encouraging, and especially for babies who spend long hours in non-parental care, even in nice daycare centers, they don't get the same kind of security and emotional support that children who are raised by their parents get. And so I honor the fact that women like to care, and I don't think we should be pushing against it. By the way, if you look at the caring professions, women dominate. You know, when you look at veterinary medicine and pediatric medicine and psychology and social work, women just rock. Why? Well, you could say it's socially constructed. I say it's because women really enjoy person-to-person contact, and they have psychological insight that they bring to bear, and it's something that means a lot to women.
I love the balance with which you're talking about this, because you're not suggesting that if a female wants to be a CEO, a business leader, something in that field, that is wrong and that women should be carrying her at home at all. But what you are saying is that feminism seems to have made that a lesser call and something that actually is sort of the junior varsity when it comes to a vocation in life, which is caring for our kids or being a caring profession.
That's right. And by the way, the other thing that I stress is that we are so fortunate in this time and place. We're blessed with long lives. And with any luck, most of us will live a long time, and there's time enough to take, you know, cut back, be with your kids. You know, I worked part-time when my kids were young. That seems to be a plurality of women prefer that. And then if you add in the number of women who choose to have no work outside the home when their children are young, that's a vast majority. Only a minority choose full-time work. But in any event, the choice to work part-time is something that will not damage people in the long run. Or if it does, see, this is the thing. There's so much of a tendency in our society, and I quote the New York Times on this, to say, well, when women cut back to be mothers, they are the losers because they don't make as much money over their lifetimes as their husbands who are constantly employed and haven't cut back. Well, you could say they're losers, but I challenge that entire assumption. I don't feel that I was a loser. I think many women feel that they, and the data support this, women who cut back on their careers while their children are young are extremely happy with their decisions. They feel that they are better off, their children are better off, their husbands are better off. And when families are strong, and that is part of making strong families, then the society is healthier and stronger. So everybody gains. And you can say, look, there are always trade-offs in life. Yes, you trade off more money for a happier, healthier family. But it was a trade that I was certainly extremely happy to make. And I think many women feel the same way. And men.
Yeah, as I've invested in my career, one of my griefs is early on, I missed out on many of the early years of my kids' lives in some significant ways, and very jealous of my wife, Hallie, having had that time, because, you know, careers end just like that. So we've only got about 30 seconds left, Mona, but what would you say is sort of the pathway forward where we recognize women have not been treated well in this world? How do we bring this whole thing together?
Well, one thing is we have to end the sex wars. We have to end the idea that women thrive at the expense of men and vice versa. In fact, we all thrive when we recognize that men and women are dependent on one another and that we do best when we are married and have stable families and make and not make sacrifices but make trade-offs and exchanges and try to give more than we get. And I feel that giving rather than trying to have it all is actually the secret to a happy and well-balanced life.
Mm. It's Mona Charon. The book is Sex Matters, How Modern Feminism Lost Touch with Science, Love, and Common Sense. It is available on Amazon. I really recommend picking up this book. It's going to be a great read. Mona, thank you again so much for joining us this morning, and would love to have you back on the show.
Thank you so much. Take care.
It's Faith Radio Mornings. I'm Dr. Peter Capstan. We'll be back in just a minute. You know, Logan, I love how Mona sort of challenges some of the ongoing assumptions that are gaining momentum in our country and in our schools and sometimes even in our churches, that really what's true is there's no gender distinction. There's just blurring lines. We can kind of pick what we want. And those assumptions gain some steam, but that doesn't mean necessarily that they're true. And I'm a big science guy, and I love the things that get taught. But there was another assumption that was challenged yesterday, and that was the idea that there could be the possibility of a super volcano brewing under Massachusetts, Vermont, and New Hampshire. And the scientists came out and said, this actually challenges the textbook concepts taught in introductory geology classes. We don't really know what's going on here. I love that. You know, there's flat earth stuff coming around here, Logan. I know you're a big believer in flat earth, right? That's my understanding.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, when you can't see the sun for half of the day, it must be underneath us, right?
Well, that's what I think. But then I wonder, all the people who are underneath, how do they even stand on the earth itself? I don't get how all of this works, Logan.
You know, science is tested, but not 100% guaranteed. So take it with a grain of salt.
Indeed. Well, it was a great first hour with Tommy Binion and Mona Charon. Stay with us. We'll take a break for top of the hour in news and be back in the second half of the hour, or first hour, with Dr. David Stevens.
Again, thanks for listening to this podcast of Faith Radio Mornings. You can hear other podcasts at myfaithradio.com. Plus, remember, we are listener-supported, so your support makes Faith Radio Mornings and the other programs from Faith Radio possible. Make your gift at myfaithradio.com.